from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, after narrowly avoiding a collapse in talks on Friday, the two sides of the Syrian peace conference reached a tentative agreement to allow women and children to leave at least one area in the old city of Homs, besieged by armed groups. The peace talks stalled earlier this morning, however, and the real question is there hope in Geneva? We'll get the latest on the efforts to end Syria's violent civil war, and we'll examine the ways the conflict is spilling into neighboring countries. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Talks got underway on Friday in Geneva, Switzerland, between representatives of the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition. And at first, refusing to meet face-to-face, by Saturday they were together, though all questions went through United Nations mediator Lakhdar Brahimi. The three-year civil conflict in Syria has already accounted for the loss of some 130,000 lives and has driven some 9.5 million from their homes, creating a major refugee and humanitarian crisis. A glimmer of hope was vested in the fact that a tentative agreement was apparently worked out over the weekend for women and children to leave the besieged old city of Homs. But as you heard on NPR News just a few moments ago, the talks reached an impasse earlier this morning over the proposed change to a transitional government. In this morning's opening Forum hour, we turn our attention to the ongoing war in Syria and to the attempts to work through the conflict that are going on in Geneva as we speak. We want to go first to Geneva and welcome Bridget Kendall, who is a diplomatic producer for the BBC, who has been diplomatic correspondent, who's been covering these talks from the outset. And welcome, Bridget Kendall. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Nice to be with you.
I guess the place to begin is it doesn't appear to be a great surprise that things broke down immediately when they started talking about transitional government. That was from the first communique in Geneva, because the Syrian government was saying, or the representatives of the Syrian government were saying, there's a red line here. They were using President Obama's language.
Well, that's right. They said that when they arrived at these talks, that the red line was there'd be no discussion about President Assad's future. And if you're going to talk about a political transition in Syria, that does imply a transition from President Assad to something else. So this morning, when the government delegation were invited to give their views on this matter, they put forward a document of principles, they said, for Syria. And they talked about all sorts of different things, about getting rid of terrorism in Syria, of stopping foreign countries arming rebels, no imposed formulas from abroad, and that Syria should choose its own political formula for how it governs itself. But no talk of a transition of power, of which we understand the opposition said, well, you can't do that because we're here to discuss a communique which set the basis for this peace process. And it absolutely explicitly says in the middle of it, the heart of it, we're going to talk about a transition. And we understand that after less than an hour of talks, the mediator, Mr. Lakhdar Brahimi, said, well, OK, that's enough. Let's stop for this morning and part. So we can imagine that actually that discussion got pretty heated.
But we are reading that these talks are going to continue despite the stalemate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that is the glimmer of optimism here. We just had a news conference with Mr. Brahimi every evening at about this time here in Geneva. He updates us on how the day has gone. He sounded a bit downhearted today. He said there'd been no movement on this question of getting humanitarian aid into this city that's been besieged in Homs, in Syria, Homs. And there really hadn't been much progress on anything else. But he said, he explicitly said he was glad there was the will to continue, and he never expected any miracles. And in fact, somebody said to him, look, you know, if you're going to talk about the politics of Syria, how are you going to get over this logjam that one side says President Assad has to stay and the other says it has to go? And Mr. Brahimi just looked at them and said, well, any ideas would be welcome.
Mr. Brahimi had said earlier, however, that he was quite optimistic. He said it's better to go slow, and it's been useful, the talks, especially when they came to that tentative agreement about the besieged area of the old city of Homs. But the fact of the matter is, at this point, that seems to also be pretty much, well, held up, huh?
Well, I think last night, you know, he announced that he hoped that the Syrian government would give a green light for this convoy, which the UN, I think there are 12 trucks that the UN has on standby, and they've been working on this plan with US and Russian backing and working with the authorities in Damascus and involving the opposition. Actually, they've been doing it for weeks, long before these peace talks began. And so I think he had really hoped that they might be able to show this as a success even before these talks started. And they were hopeful last night they were getting somewhere, but then it turned out that all that was being on offer was this offer for the very vulnerable, weak women and children to leave homes, but not the men unless they gave their names, which sounded pretty ominous. Put their names on a list. And this wasn't actually an agreement to let the convoy in. And 24 hours on, we still haven't got that. So I think that's why Mr. Brahimi sounded today a bit more downhearted. I noted that he said, at one point he said, I am begging, asking both sides to do something about this. And he was talking about besieged areas all over Syria, whether in Homs or in other areas where it's rebel fighters who are holding people trapped in their homes. And right at the end of the conference, he said that he hoped all the parties would cooperate. And then he said, and I do hope those who have influence will make this work. So you get the sense that he does realize it's very fragile. And he keeps telling us, we're just going from day to day. He had a phrase today I thought was quite telling. He said, I'm just doing what the market will bear. He's just pushing it as far as he can each day, while knowing that the two sides are really just as far apart as ever, hoping that through the passage of time, I think, he can somehow get somewhere.
Bridget Kendall, again, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, joining us from Geneva this morning. We thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We are going to continue talking about Syria this hour, and Anya Manuel is with us. She's a lecturer with the International Policy Studies Program at Stanford, also a partner at Rice Hadley Gates LLC, a strategic consulting firm. She served as an official in the State Department, from 2005 to 2007. Good morning.
Thank you.
Glad to
Good
have
morning.
You back with us on Forum. Likewise to you, Fred Lawson, here in studio, professor of government and the Government Department head of Mills College, author of Global Security Watch Syria. Welcome again.
Thanks.
And let me ask you to begin with you, if I may. We're going to also talk with the Northern California chapter head of the Syrian American Council, but just get a reading from you, Fred, about this logjam. I mean, it almost seems like it's irreconcilable. And the fact of the matter is that you've got the opposition, as some are saying, not necessarily the boots on the ground. You've got the Syrian representatives taking orders from Damascus. These people are pretty removed from what's going on in Syria.
That's exactly right. Although I've got to say up front that it's a little surprising to me that Lakhdar Brahimi went immediately so quickly to the discussion of a transitional governing body. One would think there might be other things that would lay the groundwork. Ambassador Brahimi claimed that he was going to do some confidence building before getting to the major questions at hand. So to bring the major question at hand up so quickly does seems surprising to me.
He did say he was going to go slowly in this. And how does this strike you, Anya Manuel? I mean, just in terms of the way this has been moving.
I think it's very good that the parties are talking. It's not a surprise that there's a stalemate over transitional government. And I just hope that keeping the talks going doesn't become a goal in and of itself, and that then becomes an excuse to avoid other actions that might help protect Syrians and Syrian civilians on the ground.
Well, I was reading Les Gelb, now President Emeritus of the Council of Foreign Relations, who said in the Daily Beast, I have to face the fact that Assad is here to stay. And as much of a monster as he is, in fact, Les Gelb used the word sins, United States under Kerry, particularly talking about Assad has to go, is choosing the wrong side, or they should work with the moderates. See it that way, Anya Manuel?
I have a lot of respect for Les Gelb. I don't quite agree with him. I do think he's right that we may have no choice but to let Assad stay because of, you know, actions we've taken and Hezbollah and Iran have taken over the past 2 years. But my view at this point would be that there is still an option to arm only with ground weapons the somewhat moderate rebel forces in a way that we haven't done before, and at least try to get them to fight to a stalemate. I think an even better thing would be if everybody stops arming the sides, but I think that's quite unlikely since Iran and Hezbollah are very committed to helping Assad. Russia has provided tons and tons of weapons to the Assad side, and the West hasn't done anything similar for the moderates.
Yeah, but the Saudis are supplying the other side with weapons, and that other side is, Fred Lawson, quite mixed. I mean, there are moderates, but there are a lot of jihadis, more every day, it seems.
Yeah, well, no, that's quite right. And to go back to your original question, I really think it is important to see what forces are represented in Geneva and which ones have stayed away. The groups that are present in Geneva are largely the ones that are most amenable to some kind of compromise, most amenable to talking to the regime. It's a group of liberals and a group of civil rights activists, many of them largely based outside the country. There's a small group of Muslim Brothers connected to this delegation as well. But again, the Muslim Brothers have turned out to be pretty deeply divided right at the moment, and divided exactly about whether to negotiate with the regime in any way at all. But as you mentioned in your opening comments, important forces are not present at Geneva. The most important forces that are not present are the various Islamist militias fighting on the ground. The real forces that are combating the regime, forces that are engaged in the conflict. And as you mentioned, the groups in Geneva don't have much leverage over those groups at all.
There's also, Anya, a lot of infighting among these groups. I mean, that's to put it mildly. Zawahiri said you should stop and move into Iraq, presumably still the head of al-Qaeda, and so the hell was Zawahiri, basically. I mean, they're fighting among themselves, and they can't seem to be in agreement in terms of where this ought to go.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the situation on the ground is very complex. It's very fluid. But I think we often conflate different rebel groups. So let me just – and I agree wholeheartedly with what Fred said. I think what we're dealing with now is three big groupings of rebels. One, the Supreme Military Council / Free Syrian Army. These are the folks, by and large, who are represented at Geneva II, just like Fred said. Then there's the Islamic Front, which is a group of seven more Islamist groups that united in November 2013. These are the folks that are being funded by the Saudis, by Qatar. They are what we would consider Salafists. They want a Sunni regime in Syria, but they are not al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, which goes by the name of ISIS and al-Nusra, is the worst of the worst. And what you're seeing now is some of the more moderate groups fighting against the al-Qaeda groups.
What about you're talking, Fred Lawson, a moment ago about taking a different tack on the part of Brahimi. Maybe he should be talking about things like local ceasefires or safe corridors for delivery of badly needed humanitarian aid, talking about prisoner exchanges as opposed to what they did today, which was move right to the political front.
There really was some thought that that would be the focus of this first set of negotiations, especially the prisoner exchanges. The opposition group handed in a list of some 20,000 names of people that the opposition camp would like to know the fate of, and even better, to be released. The regime did not accept that, list and sort of ignored the appeal completely. The regime instead did propose a couple of local ceasefires, especially a ceasefire up around Aleppo, but the regime forces aren't very active up around Aleppo anyway. As Anya says, much of the fighting around Aleppo recently has involved either some of the Islamic Front forces or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So there's no skin in the game for the regime for the forces to stop fighting up in the north.
Again, Fred Lawson is professor of government and government department head at Mills College, author of Global Security Watch Syria, and Anya Manuel is a lecturer in the International Policy Studies program at Stanford and a partner at the Rice Hadley Gates LLC, which is a strategic consulting firm. And Faris Alahu is president of the Northern California chapter of the Syrian American Council and joins us by phone. Good to have you with us, Mr. Alahu, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I guess the question has come up here implicitly in our conversation. I'd like to get your response to it, that the opposition is highly divided, not only in terms of what's going on in Syria, but perhaps even in Geneva. And those who are representing the opposition in Geneva are not necessarily, well, how shall I put this? The Syrian government has said, or the Syrian government representative said, they're taking their marching orders from Syria as well.
I think the opposition is united on wanting a dictator to be removed from power, you know, a family that has been ruling over Syria for 50 years, and they are the opposition is united on bringing peace to the Syrian people. Now, one thing that in terms of what's going on in Geneva, I mean, what the tactics that the regime is using, and this is just a personal story. Speaking with my sister in Homs, she got an electric bill equivalent to, say, like $2,000 here. Let's say and they use all kind of tactics on people, not just bombing and killing, but also things that they have in power to force people to leave or to go by what the government wants to do. So in terms of the opposition, I think they're all united on wanting a transitional government, which was a cornerstone of the Geneva II, is the agreement to be based on what was agreed to in Geneva I, that to have a transitional government. But unfortunately, the regime, using all sort of tactics, from bombing to killing to even forcing people out of their homes and not allowing the UN and other support and aid to come to the besieged areas.
Well, we heard earlier, one of those besieged areas, of course, is the old city of Homs. And if there's going to be a humanitarian convoy, or if there's going to be any way of allowing women and children to actually get out of there in the present situation in which they're really blockaded, it's going to have to come down to, apparently we heard this from the BBC correspondent, presenting a list of all the men there. I mean, this seems, as the BBC correspondent said, ominous. It does to you, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, the regime, they ignore, they say there are no children, no women, there are no prisoners. I mean, they don't, and this, even the back in the 80s, the father did the same thing. I have family members who are...
Bashar Assad, yes.
Yeah, his father did the same thing in the 80s. When I grew up in Syria, I used to watch the TV there, and they said, there are no prisons. You know, we have democracy, we have freedom. And the same thing now we have. I mean, the numbers, the names are provided of children, women, and men in prison, and the regime says, no, this is not, we're not going to accept it. So unless, I think the international community needs to apply more pressure on the regime to force that transitional government. That's really key. And once that's in place, then we can talk about prisoners exchange, about more humanitarian support. But anything besides that transitional government, it's just going to delay and continue these talks for the sake of the talks.
Faris Alahu, again, is president of Northern California Chapter of the Syrian American Council, and we thank you for joining us. Good to hear from you this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Let me go back to our two guests here in studio, Anya Manuel and Fred Lawson. And it seems to be almost on the face of it, Anya Manuel, an impossible logjam. What we're hearing from one side is Assad has to go, and from the other side is you have to get rid of the terrorists. I mean, this is diametrical opposition, and it doesn't sound like anything can positive come out of it.
It is absolutely a logjam, and I agree with Faris that the talks alone probably won't achieve our desired outcome. But there is a range of policy options here. I think when we talk about the conflict, we often say, well, either the U.S. is going to go to war or we're going to try peace talks. But there's a whole range of options in the middle that we haven't really tried. We've given mostly non-lethal and some humanitarian aid to rebels. We haven't really done a lot to arm the moderate rebels. We have not done a lot to put pressure on Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and we have not asked those countries in particular to put pressure on the private donors in those countries who are funding the worst of the worst.
Have we made a mistake by pretty much keeping Iran out of this? I'm talking about the Geneva talks, Fred Lawson.
I think we certainly have. One of the things that we might have learned from the Dayton negotiations over Bosnia was that one of the crucial elements of a successful negotiation is to have all of the parties involved, to have as many stakeholders as possible around the table. And so to leave Iran out, which has such a presence with Hezbollah, has a strategic alignment with Damascus, Iran might be one of the few countries that could exercise some sort of leverage on the al-Assad regime. And to simply reject having Iran in the room does seem like a recipe for ineffectiveness.
Well, also, one could think that Russia has some leverage with the Damascus regime. I don't know if that's as strong as Iran's, because Iran is supplying a lot more weaponry. But fact of the matter is that there's been some contentiousness going on just over the Olympics now between the United States and Russia, which some say is creating a little bit more of a Cold War type of freeze.
No, Russia does have leverage. And I'd be willing to say that about the only reason that Syria has agreed to come to these talks is because of some sort of Russian pressure, some sort of expectation from Moscow that Damascus needs to do this in order to look halfway respectable.
So how do you respond, Anya Manuel, when you hear Secretary of State Kerry saying Assad must go? I mean, he's essentially echoing, one could argue from the opposition standpoint, the first communique, but he said the deterioration is a responsibility. It's all culpability of Assad and the Assad regime.
That's right. Well, Secretary Kerry is in a difficult position. He can't back off from what President Obama has said, which is that Assad must go. But our stated goal of Assad leaving has not to date matched U.S. actions. We have not acted as if we want Assad to go in the ways that I described.
In fact, some are saying that President Obama, as opposed to Secretary Kerry, has been backtracking a bit. I don't know if you read it, either of you read it that way, but that's some commentators and some analysts saying.
You know, that's certainly one way to go, is to have the United States step up the pressure and to make things even more uncomfortable for the existing regime. But one of the things we learn from looking at Latin American transitions is that the existing leadership has to be reassured that it won't be strung up or executed the day after regime transition takes place. So at least some effort to reassure the existing regime, some effort to lay a foundation for the existing leadership to leave office seems to me crucial, and no one's paying attention to that at all.
Do you know why I brought up this, again, kind of Cold War thing? Because Russia said only Assad can run this government in Syria. I mean, again, there can be no greater diametrical opposition when you have the Secretary of State saying of the United States he must go. And
well, the Russians are certainly looking at the situation through the lens of Islamist militants inside Russia, of these groups in the North Caucasus that are engaged in terrorist activities, that have bombed Volgograd, that are challenging Russia at home. And Russia, I think, identifies a little bit with the leadership in
Damascus. This is where Les Gelb's ideas come in again, it seems to me. My grandfather used to say, this czar is bad enough, we don't need a new one. And you could say that about the Sunni jihadis taking over Syria, which is really a plausible scenario. I'm going to open up the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation. We're talking about the Syrian Peace Conference. It's hit an impasse earlier today, expected impasse, anticipated, I think it's fairly safe to say. But the talks are still essentially going on. Where can they lead? Will this violent civil war, this horror show, which is nothing less than what we've seen in all the carnage, have no end? What about the logjams we've been discussing here? You may want to weigh in. And in fact, we welcome your involvement in the program. Any questions or comments you might have? Our toll-free number, by the way, I also ought to mention that this is created, as I said earlier, a terrible refugee as well as humanitarian problem, the civil war, and neighboring countries have and continue to face refugees pouring in by the thousands. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us, and please feel free to do that now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also post any questions or comments immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Are you hopeful about Geneva? Do you have shards of hope in the midst of this, that something may be a tipping point or a breakthrough here? And what would you like to ask our two experts? We welcome your involvement. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. Two experts I alluded to, Fred Lawson, professor of government and government department head at Mills College. His book is Global Security Watch Syria. And Anya Manuel, a lecturer in the International Policy Studies program at Stanford, also a partner at Rice-Hadley Gates LLC, which is a strategic consulting firm, and she served as an official in the State Department from 2005 to 2007. We'll hear from you, our listeners, all about Syria when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Kresge. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the attempts to work toward a peace in Syria. There are talks continuing in Geneva. They hit an impasse earlier today. We got an update from diplomatic correspondent Bridget Kendall, who's with the BBC, and we also spoke with Faris Alahu, who is president of the Northern California chapter of the Syrian American Consul. Two guests in studio are Anya Manuel, lecturer in the International Policy Studies program at Stanford, and Fred Lawson, who is professor of government and government department head at Mills College. And we do want your involvement in the program in this last half hour and hear what you have to say or what you're thinking about the possibility of moving forward in terms of some kind of brokerage of a peace in Syria. And really, one of the big questions I'd like to put to listeners, too, is how much of a role should the United States be playing behind the scenes or diplomatically in attempting to move or create as much leverage as possible? Your calls and emails are welcome. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and let's go to our calls. And we'll begin with Ben. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my question. I was wondering if the members of the panel thought that the situation in Syria was starting to look a little bit like Iraq following the first Gulf War, where we had loose support for the opposition, and then it crumbled when we pulled away.
Anya, Manuel?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I think it's gone, unfortunately, well beyond that. After the Gulf War in 1991, you're absolutely right. There was an uprising by the opposition. America didn't intervene, and it was crushed. In Syria, you have a full-blown, absolutely cruel civil war. And I think the idea that the opposition will just go be crushed and leave Syria is we're well beyond that. We're more in a situation that's parallel to what happened in Bosnia.
Fred Lawson.
It's important to remember that the United States is a little bit stuck here. Any Syrian group that would openly align with the United States would instantly be charged of being a tool of outside intervention, a tool of outside imperialism. The United States really can't afford, I think, to cultivate clients among any of the Syrian parties. And what the United States might better do is somehow work on the situation, on the context, rather than choosing up partners. We all remember that in Iraq, after the second Gulf War, the United States had designated Ahmed Shelebi to be the head of the new transitional government. No one on the ground knew him. Ahmed Shelebi was run out on a rail pretty quickly after he was put in place. The U.S., I think, learned a lesson from that situation.
But the U.S. has chosen sides. It said, we want Assad to go. And in respect to also arming the moderates, as best one can arm the moderates, it's chosen sides.
It has chosen a side. I think the conflict has gotten awfully personalized. That is, what would happen if Bashar al-Assad would actually go to a five-star hotel in Qatar tomorrow? Would that actually change things on the ground? What we see in Egypt is that a whole set of political institutions stayed in place even after the leadership changed. So I think one thing that has to be worked out is how much change in the structure of Syria is really involved here. Would a transitional government only be a new leader on top of the existing state, or does some really deep, profound transformation have to take place?
Another side of this, Anya Manuel, that I'd like to that I'd like to get your thoughts on is what we're seeing in Syria play out. I think, according to most obvious lights, is a battle between Sunni interests and Shiite interests. And although the Alawites are a sect, they still have been backed traditionally by the Shias and by Iran. What I'm wondering here is there's all this talk about if the opposition managed to form a Sunni jihadist government, it would be impossible for minorities who have, at least for a fairly reasonable amount of time under the Assad regimes, I'm talking about Kurds, of course, Christians and so forth, been able to live and been able to be part of the society's fabric. It would be harder for them, in other words.
Yeah, that's right. I think the worst case scenario is al-Nusra or ISIS actually win the conflict and try to establish a regime in Syria. I also think that's extremely unlikely.
Why?
Nobody wants them to win. Then you have Assad uniting with the moderate rebels, with Russia, with the U.S. Nobody wants these folks to win, even though they are causing massive havoc. And I'm glad that you mentioned that this is a Sunni-Shia split, because this is not just a Syria problem. This threatens to tear apart the Middle East at its seams. You see this in Iraq, where there is a massive al-Qaeda problem in a way that we really haven't seen since 2007. That is directly related to what's going on in Syria. It's the same groups. You have a massive instability being caused in Jordan with the refugees and the government reeling under having to house all these refugees, with Lebanon, where you're seeing lots of sectarian bombings, in Turkey, where they've tried to close the border because they're worried about fundamentalists coming over. This is a real problem in the entire Middle East. And one last thing that we have to remember is that our talks with Iran on the nuclear deal are also, of course, influenced by this.
The only country that seems stable, as Tom Friedman pointed out in recent articles, is Tunisia, because he argues they have the kind of diversity that they can live with in terms of government being represented by a whole potpourri of different faiths and different peoples and so forth. But I think it was one of Assad's advisors, you can help me with the pronunciation here, Bouthania Shabau, who said the opposition, you couldn't get five Syrians to vote for the opposition. I mean, particularly if it were, as you suggested, the jihadists.
No, Bouthania Shaban has tended to argue that the regime is in place as a result of elections. There have been elections. The regime claims that there's a kind of opposition inside the country. Let's call it a loyal opposition, who are not actually members of the Ba'ath Party. So when the regime uses the term opposition, the regime means people who have remained in Damascus and who are critics of the regime but have not rejected the regime. And that's why the regime talks about terrorists in Geneva, because anyone who has left the country, anyone who doesn't accept the existing state of affairs, is not really part of the opposition, but is beyond the pale.
And it's pretty clear that the opposition, from their statements, this is not just rhetoric, we're not going to give the keys of Damascus to these terrorists. I mean, that's essentially how they've framed it. Let me go to more of your calls, and we go to Ram. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I've read in newspapers in Lebanon and Kuwait and other regional papers that Assad and his mukhabarat was the ones who created the ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra in the first place by releasing all the jihadists from their prisons. Now the West is trying to work with the Assad by, I guess, removing Assad but keeping the regime in place to destroy these very same groups when the regime is the one that created the groups in the first place. That seems kind of contradictory, correct?
I don't know. Is there any truth to that, Fred Lessons? Like Israel created Hamas, the argument goes. Same kind of argument.
It is just like that argument. One of the key figures in Geneva, Michel Kilou, one of the civil rights activists in Damascus, did make that charge last week. And he claims he has documentary evidence that many of the leaders of the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant had been inside the Syrian security forces. They had been put in prison on a pretense, and then when they were released, they were moles inside the Islamist movement and have generated this radical militant Islamist movement in order to discredit the opposition. To me, that sounds a little too clever by half. It's not clear to me that the Syrian regime could actually carry out such a complicated plan. It's more likely, I think, that it's an unintended consequence of the rise of these militant Islamist movements that the opposition has been undercut and that the opposition has lost and that the liberal civil rights opposition has lost momentum in the war.
Getting a lot of strong comments from listeners. Let me read some of them, and then I'll go to more of your calls. Amina writes on our website, this is not a sectarian conflict. This is a megalomaniac who is willing to murder and destroy the entire nation in order to stay in power. He has murdered thousands and maimed, tortured, and raped thousands more. He is a war criminal and should be treated at The Hague. Since when does the world negotiate with war criminals? Joe writes, the word is that the Saudis told some of the most violent criminals in their prisons to go to Syria to fight for their God or face execution. And this is part of why so many atrocities are happening in Syria. The so-called jihadists were common murderers and rapists. And, of course, whatever the Saudis do is done with the blessing of the USA. Again, any truth to this that you know of, Fred Lawson?
Well, one thing that I think is clear is that the Saudis have no love lost at all with the Muslim Brothers inside Syria. Various Muslim Brothers from Syria emigrated to Saudi Arabia in the 1970s and 1980s and became the core of the Islamist opposition inside Saudi Arabia. So there's really bad blood between the Saudi regime and the Muslim Brothers. So in an effort to undercut the Muslim Brothers, the Saudis have armed and have supported a number of alternative Islamist groups. I'm not sure we would want to call them moderate, but they're not jihadis in the sense of global jihad. They're they're jihadis in the sense of overturning the current regime and keeping Syria more or less intact.
Ana Manuel?
I think that's right. And I would add to that, you have to really distinguish between the Saudi government and private Saudi donors. So the Saudi government has been doing a lot of funding for a group called Jaish al-Islam, which is sort of in the spectrum of good to unsavory. They're somewhere in the middle. Private Saudi, Kuwaiti, and Qatari donors are funding the worst of the worst.
I met a listener named Colin who writes online, "My heart goes out to the Syrian people who have been the victims of a brutal civil war. Having said that, I can't see any national interest of the United States being involved by taking sides in what is basically a sectarian conflict of Sunnis against Shiites, Alawites, and other factions. How many of the armchair warriors calling for the U.S. to depose the Syrian regime would sacrifice their own children to that end?" And Malcolm writes, "In every case, the international arms industry profits by these conflicts, and no one will speak of it. All these conflicts would disappear if no one had weapons. Why the cowardice about dealing with this subject?" That's a fair point, Manuel. We don't hear necessarily all that kind of hue and cry about the international arms industry here, and it does play a central role.
It does. But let me go back and talk about the previous comment, which said, you know, no one, why would you want to send your children into this conflict? I agree. I don't think there is any willpower, nor would I advocate the U.S. going to war in Syria. We are war weary, no matter how just this cause. But as I said before, there are a lot of policy options that are between going to war and doing nothing. For example, and Fred brought up in the first half of the hour, the Bosnia conflict. In the Bosnia conflict, we had all parties at the table. And part of the reason the Dayton Accords actually achieved the peace is because we had a no-fly zone, which is very difficult and probably won't happen in Syria. But we also turned a blind eye when American contractors trained the Croats to become a much more effective fighting force, to essentially fight to a stalemate. We have had nothing of the kind here.
Fred Lawson?
If the conflict does start spreading, if it spreads into northern Iraq, if it spreads into Lebanon, as it appears to do.
Already done so, in
yes,
effect.
Yes, just a couple of days ago. Yeah. This group, the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant, set up a Lebanese branch, announced this morning that it was now going to target Lebanese army units as part of the struggle against Hezbollah, which isn't quite clear to me how that works. But there may well be groups inside Syria that now take up the fight across the border, perhaps even in southern Turkey as well, then the chances of a regional conflict really would harm American interests.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We welcome Jordan. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My perspective is really, I think we should focus a little bit on the big picture here. First, I'd also like to make a comment that you said we're not really arming the opposition, and I think that's a little naive. This kind of reminds me of the...
Wait a minute, I don't know who said that. We are arming. We're arming what we call the moderates in the opposition.
Oh, okay.
It depends
my mistake.
Who we
I think we may not be openly driving in tanks or anything, but we are definitely arming the sides that we're interested in. My other perspective is that I think we should focus on the bigger picture. I mean, why is Russia involved in this? The way I see it is that this is just another French fight, and that we're really looking at putting someone in power who is sympathetic to the U.S. side and is not going to give all their natural resources to Russia and China, when I really think that's the kind of goal. That's the reason it's Cold War-esque, as you mentioned earlier.
Are you seeing this, Jordan, as a Sino-Soviet kind of conflict, then, as opposed to a Saudi-Iranian conflict?
Yeah, well, I mean, why are there so many big players involved in this? There's plenty of civil wars that go on over the world that we don't have any interest in, but why are we interested in this one? Why are we so focused on this? And I guarantee you it's because of resources.
Well, what do you think, Fred Lawson?
Well, this seems to me to be Russia's chance to reemerge as a great power, to reemerge as a major player in world affairs. Foreign Minister Lavrov has played his cards very carefully. Russia has gone back into the one part of the Middle East that Russia still had a little tiny foothold. On December 21st, Russia signed an agreement, on December 25th, excuse me, Russia signed an agreement with Syria to reinvigorate Syria's oil wells and bring Russian oil companies into Syria. The most interesting news of the month has been that there's a set of People's Republic of China warships that have now entered the Mediterranean to help escort the chemical weapons that are being taken aboard ship. So both China and Russia see this conflict as an attempt to begin to eclipse the United States as the central great power.
Well, Russia has always had Syria as a proxy, though. I mean, and has had Syria pretty much in its corner. And to some extent, one would argue, even though both Assad, father and son, were fairly substantially autonomous in their own right, they came under a great deal of influence by the Soviet Union all those years, and continue to have a very strong bond with present-day Russia. Here's Sarah, who tweets, listening in this morning to the talk on Syria, I wanted to ask about the term used. What do you mean by a Sunni jihadist government?
Well, it's really not clear in Islamic doctrine or Islamic theology how a government should be set up. There's a good deal of disagreement. There's a big gap about what kind of administration the community of believers should have. The one model that we have of an Islamic government is the Islamic Republic of Iran. But the Islamic Republic of Iran is a very new conception. It's an innovation that Ruhollah Khomeini came up with while he was sitting in exile in Iraq. Other than that, groups like the Muslim Brothers of Egypt, groups like the Muslim Brothers of Syria, have drifted in the direction of liberal democracy. Maybe there should be elections. Maybe the representatives of the people should be elected. What we might mean by a jihadist Islamist government is one in which there's a leader that sets the terms, a much more authoritarian regime, an authoritarian regime where there's one interpretation of Islam, one way of doing things. And what we see in the middle of Syria today, in the important city of Araqqa, is a part of the country where the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant has taken over the province and has created what it calls an Islamic form of government. And it's pretty strict and it's pretty restrictive, and women do not show up on the streets, and people who offer any kind of criticism of the regime are treated brutally. So if that's what is meant by a jihadist Islamist form of government, it does look pretty awful.
Well, it's what Afghanistan looked like under the Taliban.
It looks a lot like the Taliban.
Yeah, and Assad has said, by the way, if there are elections, he will run. Here's a quote. We'll get back to Russia for a moment with you, Anya Emanuel. Chet writes, the U.S. lost a huge amount of leverage when Obama submitted the decision of bombing the chemical sites to Congress. That was when the Russians were able to take the lead. It now looks to me like the Russians have made the better choice. Didn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I think that whole flurry of activity around Syria in August was complex and problematic for the ultimate outcome, and for the following reasons. President Obama drew two red lines. One, Assad must go, and two,
No
chemical weapons. Right. So Assad's still in power. Assad uses chemical weapons. 1,500 people died in that chemical weapons attack. That's a tragedy. But 125,000 have died in the conflict through just ordinary weapons.
And the only reason we've been able to move forward, presumably, where chemical weapons are concerned is because of the Russians.
That's right. And I have to say, I think we got a little bit distracted. It is wonderful that they are giving up their chemical weapons, that they are being shipped out. That is fantastic. But that is only one of the interests we have in the Syrian conflict. The others are the massive humanitarian crisis and the fact that this is tearing the Middle East apart.
Some more emails from listeners. Paul writes, there seems to be a pathological enmity among peoples of the Middle East. This is a centuries-old matter. It's fatuous to think that these negotiations will fix such a long-standing problem. And George writes, will we never learn? Our problems in Syria might stem from our failed attempt to overthrow the Syrian government 50-odd years ago. Do you suppose Syrians remember? Will we never learn? We throw our support behind an expatriate cadre representing no one in particular and wonder why the situation crumbles before our eyes. And Chris asks, why did Kerry insist Iran not be in the talks? Fred Lawson.
I really wish that I knew. I think that it would have been a really important step, not only inside Syria, but as Anya said, for current negotiations with Iran. Iran is looking for some kind of reinforcement for the moderation that it's shown about the nuclear research program. And so to be squeezed out of Geneva, to be slapped publicly that way, to have a public invitation rescinded, seems like a very poor act of diplomacy. Mm-hmm.
I think the Obama administration is justifiably concerned about empowering Iran just as we are negotiating with them over their nuclear weapons program. So in the same way that Russia has been vastly empowered by this because they are playing their cards right, there could be the same effect.
A power play, basically.
It's a power play.
Yeah.
Could I say something really quickly about the first two of those email comments? I think the second comment is crucial, the comment that, in fact, Syria has had various experiences. It's had experience with liberal democratic government. It's had experience with United States secret services overturning governments in Syria. There's a whole tradition of relations between the West and the Syrian government that makes Syria suspicious, that makes the Assad regime wonder about what the real intentions of the U.S. might be. And it's those historical experiences that are more important than any presumed long-time antagonism across religious divides.
Certainly holds true with Iran, too, doesn't it? And just a reminder that you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Fred Lawson from Mills College and Anya Manuel from Stanford. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to Berkeley. Amina, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. The racism that is conveyed in some of these comments is really disturbing. When we are talking about people fighting for democracy, going out in the street with overwhelmingly peaceful protests, massive crackdown, thousands murdered, thousands raped, thousands maimed, and people are sitting around talking about, do we want this government or that government? Would we react that way if this was a Western nation? It's really sickening that the bastion of democracy cannot come forward and support those who are calling for democracy, as President Obama did at the beginning of this revolution.
Fred Lawson.
Thank you for reminding us that, in fact, two important groups are not represented in Geneva, and there are two groups that we might, as Americans, think were the heroes of the peace. One of them is the local coordinating committees that started the armed struggle against the regime, that tried to protect local communities against the security services and the pro-regime thugs. And the other is the coalition of prominent civil rights activists that has stayed inside Syria, this group that calls itself the National Coordinating Committee of the Forces for Democratic Change. These groups are desperate to bring about some kind of change inside Syria, to bring it about nonviolently, but to bring it about without becoming clients or stooges of outside forces. And anything that we could do to help those movements get stronger would certainly be to the good.
Right. Anya Manuel.
I think I completely agree with the caller. The most depressing aspect of this entire conflict is that this was young people who had had enough of dictatorship, who rose up against the Assad regime, who wanted a democratic transition. And because they received no assistance and Assad cracked down as hard as you could possibly imagine, this has turned into a civil war. And civil wars bring out the worst of the worst. And the good guys have been sidelined.
There's a strange thought that just found its way into my consciousness, and that is when Bashar al-Assad came into power and replaced Hafez al-Assad, his father. There was a lot of talk about his being educated in the West. I mean, he was an ophthalmologist. He came under Western influences, so the argument went, and he was much more open to democracy. You heard the same thing about Gaddafi's son. I mean, are we deluding ourselves with, you know, the notion that you take the next generation, expose them to Western education, and somehow they're going to be less the tyrants than their fathers were?
Well, we were deluding ourselves with Assad. And I think a lot of people were hoping that there would be an opening to Syria. There were some talks. But he has turned out to be even more ruthless than his father.
And that's saying something. Pat is our next caller. Pat, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you, Michael, for all the work you do. We've been a long-time listener. Our doctor is from Syria and is in contact frequently with his extended family and friends there who are hiding out. And they are so afraid that Assad will be toppled and that there won't be anyone responsible to fill in for him. They've seen the other countries just fall apart into chaos, and that is their main concern, that they sort of hang on to Assad for a while and make a more gradual transition. So I just thought that was interesting, since he actually is in contact with these people. And for goodness sake, the woman who suggested sending more arms in there, please. The United States had sent so many arms, and they always end up in the wrong hands. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you for that call. There will be a power vacuum, clearly, if Assad is removed, and that's kind of the problem we're struggling with here, the conundrum. What will fill it?
Well,
it's an important concern. And last July, when the first Geneva Manifesto was released, if we read it carefully, it makes a point to keep in place the armed forces and the existing administration. The Syrians don't want to experience what Iraq experienced when the Iraqi army was disbanded and the government was dismantled on the grounds of de-Ba'athification.
Yeah, Anya Manuel.
Right. I think the listener brings up a very important comment, which is that the Alawites are running scared, and many of them support the Assad regime not out of any great love for him, but because they are terrified of what will happen to them once Sunni extremists
same true for the Kurds and same true for the Christians and
absolutely. And I think at the beginning of the conflict, there was a real opportunity to peel some of the Alawite elite away from Assad by giving them asylum in the West, by turning a blind eye if they got their finances in order and out of the country. Now that's much more difficult, and the positions have really hardened.
So do we have any rays of optimism as far as Geneva is concerned? Let's kind of tackle that big question that's been looming over this whole discussion.
Well, I was reminded this morning as I was trying to do some background reading that the negotiations over Bosnia at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton did not happen overnight. There were four sets of failed negotiations before the set of negotiations that Richard Holbrooke hammered through. So perhaps we need some kind of initial period when the two sides can yell at each other to clear some of the air before something happens next.
That's right.
Anya, final word from you?
I think negotiations are a great thing. I'm happy they are happening, but they should not be an excuse for not doing anything else.
Thank you both. Good to have you both with us on Forum. Another hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. We're going to talk about the new machine age in the hour ahead with a couple of professors from MIT. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.